This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Solutions, the leading iGaming PAM platform with a modular approach, including many benefits like a fast, secure, and scalable API-based platform integrated with all major third-party products and services. Make sure you head over to Pragmatic Solutions and join our smart thinking.
This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Play, a leading game developer providing player favorites to the most successful brands across the industry. With an award-winning multi-product portfolio of slots, live casino, bingo, virtual sports, and more, Pragmatic Play is powering up new possibilities of play through one single API. Visit pragmaticplay.com and discover your favorite every time.
And happy new year. Welcome back to the Vested Interest podcast. Lloyd and Bendy, great to have you guys with us here today. How is the energy after the holidays, Lloyd?
It's always tough to get back into the swing of things, but I'm also someone who prefers to be in motion, and too much time at rest is not ideal. So tough to get back, but good to be back in the swing of things. And hey, look, it's conference season already almost, so I'm sure we'll be seeing all you guys in person not too long from now.
Absolutely, we will. Bendy, you escaped over to Tulum, a holiday after the holiday.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say it's a holiday, more of a business trip, but yeah, right back at it. Was in Jackson Hole earlier this week on a bit of business / fun, and now in Tulum for a couple of days on business, and yeah, right back into things for sure.
Well, fantastic, guys. Well, we have an action-packed outline here in front of us today, so why don't we jump into it right away? And, you know, something that I've been made more aware of recently as a kind of startup founder myself, who is now entering the kind of the 50 year in our story since we got the first funding, is the idea of an exit strategy and when to start thinking as a startup founder or as a small business around exit strategies. And I'm really curious to know a little bit more about this topic. I mean, Bendy, obviously your claim to fame is the startup that you led to an exit yourself when you built Don Best back in the day, that eventually exited. And I want to start off on your side, Bendy. You know, when did you start thinking about kind of an exit and exit strategies and so on and so forth? Was that ever top of mind for you? Was that ever something you considered?
You know, certainly not in the early days. You know, the Don Best story is a bit of a different one and a little bit unique, and it goes back so long ago that I don't know how relevant it is to the conversation that we're having today, but there's still some parallels. And you know, it certainly, as we were going along on the journey and beginning to have some of these conversations, we were never, at least on my end, on the Don Best side, we were never really overly proactive or overly concerned or overly focused on an exit strategy. We were much more focused on day-to-day execution and building the business and increasing our EBITDA and being as profitable as we can be, and you know, ensuring that we had the appropriate cash flow metrics in place to be able to withstand things that might come up that we couldn't predict necessarily. And we're just much more focused on day-to-day execution, finding ways to grow the business, finding ways to be the best that we can be for our B2B clients and our B2C clients for that matter. We were much more focused on those things than we were on an exit strategy, and we allowed the rest to kind of take care of itself. And you know, I don't know if that's necessarily 100% the advice that I would give to startups today, because I do think that when you're getting going and you're, in particular, if you're seeking outside capital, you need to be able to show those investors, in particular, you know, VC investors, but even angel investors, you need to be able to show them that there is a path to an exit. But I think much more important is showing that you're going to be able to do the things day by day, you know, inning by inning, at bat by at bat, that will put you in the best position to achieve an exit of some sort, even if you don't have absolute clarity on what that exit will be.
Right. So even if you don't have a clear strategy as an early startup, because you can imagine that early startups, even to think about long-term strategy, is difficult as the company kind of changes and evolves and so on. But along the way, you are faced with, I certainly noticed this in my day-to-day, that we are faced with a lot of strategic decisions. And if we don't have kind of like the the long-term kind of thinking in mind, it can be quite easy, right, to kind of like entangle the company in a lot of complicated strategic relationships and strategic partnerships and so on. That can be quite difficult a couple of years later if an exit eventually becomes something that is on the map. Is that something you guys can relate to as well?
Yeah, look, I mean, along the journey in the Don Best days, there were a number of partnerships and M&A opportunities, not necessarily to sell the company, but for different components where we could acquire a company or merge with a company. And in fact, at one point in our Don Best journey, we did merge with a company by the name of Sports Options, which was competing with a component of our business, and we merged them into our business. And in fact, I think that played a role in our successful M&A in the end. Every decision that you make as a founder, every action has a reaction, right? Now, look, I'm an angel investor, right? On the investment side, so it'd certainly be super interesting to hear Lloyd's views. But at a high level, I do think that a founder, you know, as they get going with their business, the more prepared they are in terms of their plan in every component of their business, including even before they get going and before they've raised a dime, you know, including what type of exit opportunities could be the most likely, fully knowing that along the way, 101 things could change and they need to maintain some versatility, but showing that level of preparation from day one as a founder, that you've thought through not just the bootstrapping, the raising of capital, the need to get to positive cash flow as quickly as possible, the need, if you're B2C, of growing that client base, and if you're B2B, of bringing on B2B clients and all the things that come with it, the need to do all of these things, and then also having the fortitude to think about who some of the potential buyers can be. Being as specific as you can as a founder from the outset, I think plays to your favor, even though you know that you need to have the flexibility to adapt to a whole bunch of things that you can't predict along the way.
Yeah, I think that all resonates, makes a ton of sense. I would say the only thing I don't think this is a modification that I would add is, I think at day zero, at day negative one, before inception, perhaps at that point, it actually might be a red flag to me for a founder to be thinking heavily about an exit strategy. You should start and build the business that you genuinely want to build, that you're passionate about, that you think you are uniquely positioned to build. That passion and motivation hopefully should get you through the tougher times that are inevitable when building a company that pure financial motivation might not get you through. And I think that is almost always the case. There is a very, very, very small percentage of founders out there who can, and usually who have had multiple exits in the past, who can look at a market opportunity and say, ah, here is this window for me to build this specific product and sell it to this specific buyer in a 2-year time frame, and actually who can go out and execute and do that. Those people are not listening to this podcast for advice, so we can disregard them. I think for the overwhelming majority, believing in the business, having passion about it from day zero or day negative one is much, much more important than thinking about an exit strategy. But every day after that, it becomes increasingly important to at least factor in the exit to the cost-benefit analysis of almost every decision. To Benji's point, small things like, what law firm are you using? How are you incorporating your company? Who's keeping the books and records? How are you recording your board minutes and organizing all of these types of things? And as you evolve and you're making software engineering decisions and thinking about, to Benji's point, who might be natural buyers of this company down the road, and how are decisions that we are going to make today going to make it easier or harder for such a buyer to eventually acquire us? That's not to say it should be the only or even the predominant factor in every single decision, but it should be a factor and a feature. Investors definitely love to see that type of thoughtfulness. And I think investors, the point at which you start to take on investors, that's where it becomes not just something you absolutely should be factoring into all of your cost-benefit analyses, but something that reaches a much higher bar that I'm not thinking of the proper way to articulate at the moment, because I think raising money from outside investors who have different return criterion and exit expectations than you have truly deep down in your heart, not necessarily in your pitch deck, that is just almost always going to be a recipe for disaster. There are many different types of financing out there, equity financing, debt financing. Venture capital funds tend to want to make money all at once in the future. They don't want to make a bit of money every year, even if in the aggregate, it would add up to the same total amount of money as a large lump sum in the future. And so you can have a great business growing 20% a year, paying out nice dividends. You're the majority owner. You don't have a boss. You have no one to answer to. Hopefully, other than a few big decisions a year, maybe the company relatively runs itself at some point. That's a great life. There's hard to imagine many lives better than that in the world of entrepreneurship. Perhaps in some cases, there's no need to bring in a VC who wants to 10x their money from the entry point, because it's going to put pressures on you that if they're not true and authentic to how you think the business should be run, it's going to create a mismatch that is just going to lead to, you know, social, emotional, reputational, and economic distress, I think. And so that is probably my main thought, is that thinking about an exit is always prudent and critical, a factor in almost every cost-benefit analysis you'll make. But it becomes an absolutely mandatory factor to have alignment on when you're starting to take outside capital. And I think ensuring something that you might call like investor exit strategy fit is a really good thing to seek. Not to mention, it also drastically will increase the probability of success in your funding round. Pitching people or firms who are in the business of funding something that genuinely has the return profile they seek, rather than one that maybe only does in your, you know, your most aspirational projections or whatnot, that is a surefire way to increase the likelihood that you succeed at raising money.
And I just want to follow up a few points there, because Lloyd, you made some fantastic points, but you know, we're almost getting into a new topic here, which is when should a founder seek venture capital versus not seeking venture capital, and where the exit strategy plays into that, whether they should become a dividend business versus an all or nothing going for a 20X or a 50X business. And that's all almost a separate topic altogether. It is a separate topic altogether, but you're right. You know, the moment that a founder goes from bootstrapping to pursuing outside capital in a meaningful way, then the exit strategy becomes a factor, which doesn't mean that they need to splash all over their deck exactly what that exit strategy. I don't think they necessarily need to do that. It kind of depends on a number of dynamics, but you certainly need to be very prepared to answer that question. If you're getting on a call with Lloyd and you're showing what your trajectory is and what your business can do and how passionate you are about it and why there's product market fit, if it's not a part of your deck at a bare minimum, you better have at least thought about it and have a really good answer to the question, or an answer that will resonate with a venture capitalist as to what is your exit strategy. I mean, it's a standard question that any VC is going to ask, that you have to have a compelling answer to that resonates with those potential venture capitalists that would be giving you capital to help grow your business.
Right. And I think that's a little bit the point that I wanted to get to here today in this question, which is the fact that last time we spoke, we learned that when you go into meetings with venture capitalists or potential investors in general, it is so important not to perfect the pitch of talking about your own company, but also understanding the investor and what he or she wants when you are speaking to them. And the exit strategy might seem very far away from a startup founder who is just about to launch his new exciting company when he steps into that office with Lloyd and sits down to pitch his company. But actually what Lloyd is looking for is not just great ideas, perhaps, but also looking more into the future and to understand what is the eventual exit strategy. Because as a VC, it is pretty clearly understood, right, that you are looking for an exit within a fairly short time frame to that end as well. It is not a company that is going to grow slowly and make an exit in, you know, 20 years perhaps that you're looking for, but you are looking for this 10, 20, 50x multiple, right? And that's important to understand when you step into the office and take that first meeting, right?
I don't necessarily know I would agree on the short time frame. Sure. Comment. It does depend where you meet a fund in its life cycle. Most funds are set up to exist for somewhere between 10 to 12 years. And even if you were to extend the life of that, if you have successful investments, there are many ways. many ways to do that. If you invest in a company at a $10 million valuation, and at the end of year 10, it's worth $1 billion, but it's still a private company, that's a great outcome. There are many ways to get liquidity in that event. And I think, you know, I wouldn't regard that as some sort of non-success. So I wouldn't necessarily say anything about the short time frame. But otherwise, yeah, I think what I'm looking for at the early stage is confidence that this person and this team are going to be savvy enough to know the right information and the right things to be thinking about and the right questions to have in mind and the way to get those answers whenever the time comes. And so if today, when you are asked a basic question like, who do you imagine being a buyer of this business and at what price and revenue multiple, and there is no answer to that question, my concern is not that an answer doesn't exist. It's that a person who doesn't have that answer today at this moment is likely to not have other critical answers at other critical moments in the future. And so I think that it probably applies to almost every topic you talk about and is one of the things that is so much more important than actually the substance of that particular answer itself and feeling like it's some sort of proof or like scientific evidence of success.
It kind of rolls to your theme, Lloyd. Sorry, Pierre, sorry to interrupt. It kind of goes to your theme, Lloyd, that I've heard you say in other podcasts that how you do anything is how you do everything. I mean, I don't want to steal your line because it's your line, but it's a good one and it's applicable here. And, you know, look, I think that, you know, Pierre, not everyone has to be an entrepreneur and start a company, right? And you can have, there's so many different ways to live your life and to achieve success professionally and to, but if you make the decision that you want to start a business, I think that's fantastic. I would encourage it. And to Lloyd's point, you have to have that confidence and that kind of bulldog mentality along with the flexibility. And, you know, as a part of that, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying I'm going to come into our space, the gaming space, and build a business that's going to be a dividend type of business. And I'm going to boot it. I think that's perfectly fine also. But the moment you want to go, and as you did, Pierre, you know, and pursue the VC capital, then you got to be prepared to answer any and every question. And this becomes one of them. So it's just a question of the individual, you know, and to Lloyd's point, them having the confidence that they're able to answer any and every question that comes up, of which this is just one of many critical ones, but one that can't and shouldn't be ignored if you're going to be pursuing outside capital.
Right. And so in a startup's life from beginning to exit, there's obviously a lot of traps that you can fall into, not thinking about the exit strategy. And as a result of that, ending up in really complicated company structures and really complicated strategic relationships and joint ventures with other companies can certainly be one of those traps. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that 80, 90% of all startups fail eventually. I wanted to kind of dive into this a little bit more, you know, kind of causes for failures as you guys see it. You deal with a lot of startups. I'm sure you've seen some great success stories, but also the opposite as well. And so Benji, perhaps starting with you, from your experience, what are there any common denominators? Are there any factors that you see in startups failing?
Look, there's 101 reasons why businesses fail. And you know, almost the reverse of the question is more true in the sense that what are all the things that you need to do to be successful to get a startup from point A all the way to the point where you, you know, achieve success along the road and get to a point where there's an exit? There's 101 things that have to go right. And if any one thing goes wrong, that could derail the 99 out of 100 things that you did do right that could lead to a failure. So there's no one reason or no one theme or no one incident that generally is the cause overall of failures of businesses in the world at large or in the playground that we play in. But look, there's a couple of themes. You know, obviously, you can get into the whole financial piece and the difficulty of raising capital and companies that run out of capital, particularly in a tough environment. But, you know, I think that one of the things that we saw in our industry a few years ago that is causing a huge challenge for companies today is companies that raised at too high a valuation early on. So I would say that everything capital related, right? The raising of capital, how you approach it, the valuation that you approach it at and ensuring that it's going to allow for growth and not stagger your growth moving forward, how you manage your capital, the level of financial discipline that you have as a founder in being able to prepare for things that you can't necessarily predict that will happen as we go forward. I think that those are critical components and mistakes along that trajectory. You know, we could get into to more detail in all of those different metrics. I think that would be one area that I see. And I think another one is just underestimating critical components of the journey. And I think a big example of that would be, you know, you look at the B2B side of our business. And I think a lot of founders that come out of the gate, they've got some pretty good ideas, or in some instances, some great ideas. And they're able to secure some capital from some angels and friends and family, and in some cases from some VCs. But I think that on the B2B side in our space, they underestimate just how difficult it is to go from having a good idea and building out some good technology and perhaps building a better mousetrap to actually A, winning a client, and then, you know, getting the attention of that client to get the meetings, then winning that client. And then once you actually have a client that wants to come on board, you know, getting on their integration roadmap and achieving success with that integration to actually take that product live, to get to a point where you're generating some revenue, to eventually get to a point where you're generating enough revenue that your cash exceeds your expenses, and that allows you to bring on board other clientele that see that this is something that's working. That journey is an absolute, absolute beast. Every component of that journey is likely going to be 5x to 50x more difficult than you envisioned when you began this business as a founder, no matter what your vision was, just given the realities of technology and integration and sales cycles and competing priorities and shifting priorities of the various operators on the casino and sportsbook and real money gaming side. And of course, there's examples of companies that have navigated this successfully and who are achieving success and who will achieve successful exits. But I think one of the components that, from what I see, that are specific to our industry, that leads to these failures or these challenges that I'm alluding to, is underestimating what that journey will be. So for me, that would be one big one that's specific to our space.
Right. And Lloyd, over to you. I'm curious as well to know from a VC point of view. You know, we are avid readers here in the Vested Interest, and one of the most legendary business books ever written, maybe the most legendary business books ever written, is Good to Great by Jim Collins, where in the book, basically, he studies the most successful companies that have gone from being just good companies to, at some point, they have an inflection point to being great, and then they stay great, basically. And he tries to study the best of the best companies in order to understand what are the common denominators. And it's a fantastic book. But kind of the summary, to some extent, is discipline in companies and not getting ahead of themselves, doing things in the right order, setting up the company, getting the right people on the bus, and so on and so forth. And this seems to be a little bit counterintuitive to what a VC wants companies to do, which is kind of fast growth and deliver spectacular results within a decent time frame. What do you think, Lloyd, in terms of like company failures? Do you think there is that a lot of companies fail because they do get ahead of themselves and they do try to grow too quickly? And how do you marry that with kind of the VC model?
I think, you know, the point of discipline is critical at every stage of a company. It just means something different at different stages. I think Benji identified some great, really accurate, nuanced reasons why companies in this space especially struggle. I would say on the B2C side, not just in this space, but in most, the single greatest cause of startup failure is probably building things that the market just doesn't want or have a need for. But then the second greatest, and maybe the equal parts on the B2B space, is building something that people want, and for any number of reasons, cash management or marketing and sales tactics or leadership issues, failing to articulate and explain and make the market aware of the fact that you built this thing. On the B2C side, you might have a little bit more margin for error. You buy some Google or Facebook ads, you'll at least get a few people to download. And if what you're offering is good, people will use it. But on the B2B side, there's not really such an equivalent for that. And that's why I think many of the factors that Benji mentioned in particular can be really quite difficult. One of the things I've noticed in regards to discipline, though, and maybe just an earlier stage version of discipline, is that overwhelmingly, I look in my portfolio and I look at the companies that we've spoken with, there is an almost perfect direct correlation between companies who send out regular, detailed, but succinct updates to their investors and how well those companies are doing now, either from a traction perspective or at least from a perspective of being able to raise subsequent capital when needed from their investors. And I think some of these reasons are obvious. When you update your investors on a monthly basis, ideally you have some strategic investors on your cap table. That's a great way for your investors to know how they can help. Any good monthly investor update usually has a section called asks or requests, and it's 3 or 4 bullet points. Hey, we need introductions to this type of company, or we need troubleshooting getting through the sales process at that company. And no founder in the world can possibly keep in touch on a regular basis with all of their investors such that they are always apprised. So keeping people updated, you know, through regular emails is quite helpful. But I think there's some more subtle and interesting reasons and ways why that correlation exists. First of all, the type of founder who is organized and diligent enough to know the information, have it organized, put it in an email, are also the types of founders that do all the other things that successful founders end up doing. And then I think there's an even more subtle sort of interesting forcing function where when you know that on the 30th day of each month, you're going to look at the last 4 weeks of KPIs and milestones and send those to all of your investors, and you're going to look at the milestones you said you wanted to achieve in the last update and give yourself a grade on how well you did achieving those, it puts a pressure and a deadline that wouldn't otherwise exist. That I think when you compound that over months and months, and you just take a few phone calls a few days earlier and with a bit more urgency because you're just a bit more motivated to want to impress your investor and advisor group with that update that you're sending out, over the multiple year life of a startup, that really compounds. And so I think discipline is absolutely critical at the early stage. It just probably means something different. You can be spending aggressively on completely experimental campaigns, moving fast and breaking things, so to speak, but doing so in a disciplined manner where you have a quantitative approach to deciding when you need to abandon a project and a really deliberate way of taking feedback from failures and iterating into future successes. So I think my overall thoughts are discipline is equally critical at all steps. It just means something different. And I just continue to notice an unbelievable correlation between founders who send out regular, concise, but informative updates and their ability to get whatever it is that they need, especially when they're in a pinch.
Right. And Lloyd, what do you, just to not to go too nitty gritty here, but what do you want to see in those updates? How do you want your investors to, how do you want your startups to update you?
There's lots of great templates out there. I want it to be something that is as easy and automated and takes as little, you know, additional effort. The goal is not to create even 1 ounce of additional effort. Typically, you know, it includes a few bullet points on highlights of the last month, a few bullet points on lowlights of the last month, a few bullet points on the key KPIs. And usually you report on those same KPIs month after month, maybe with a quick notation as to how it's growing month over month and year over year. And then usually an asks or requests section. And I think those are probably the four key sections that I see, but everyone has a bit of their own flair and the way they do it. I do have a founder that each month takes the objective bullet points that he included from last month, puts them at the top of the email and says, you know, I give myself a 9 out of 10 on this because we achieved almost all of it except here. I get a 0 out of 10 on this objective because we, you know, failed to complete it completely. So lots of little bells and whistles that can be additive, but, you know, highlights, lowlights, KPIs and asks/requests, if you're doing that every month, three or four bullet points in each section, and doing it regularly and repeatedly, you already, I think, are doing better than most.
Brilliant, Lloyd. And segueing into the third point today, you know, we talked about the challenges of building a startup, to think early about exit strategies and think ahead and have some discipline. If you now look at the investment opportunities from an investor point of view here in 2024, specifically within the online gambling and sports betting industries, where do you see opportunity in 2024? And what's your kind of helicopter view over the landscape currently? Are we accelerating in the startup landscape? Is the startup landscape drying up somewhat? Where are we at the moment? And what type of startups are we excited over? Lloyd, if you want to start on this point.
Yeah, I think it's definitely been a tough time for a lot of startups, and there's quite a bifurcation in the market. There's a something of a flight to quality among investors, as well as maybe some of the investors who are less qualified to gauge quality dropping out of the market. So certainly, while it's a tougher time and cost of capital is higher for everyone, if you're a high quality startup with a great team and a really fast growth rate and great traction, you probably are not having any trouble raising money at all right now. Might be a bit slower and not at the valuation you would like, but you probably are truly having no trouble whatsoever. But that's the minority, and the overwhelming majority that in many cases, as Benji alluded to, perhaps raised at what are now obviously untenable valuations, you know, when revenue multiples were at their peak. Those companies are having a much, much harder time. I will say, I do think some of the doom and gloom has been over painted just a bit. There was a 2023 industry investment summary that got circulated in the last few days that I think was listing all of the published funding rounds in the space. And they compared the total number of dollars invested in companies in the space compared to 2022 and the total number of deals and all those type of data points. But what I've noticed, I don't think it's specific to the space, but certainly is the case in the space, is that a lot of companies are just not announcing their funding rounds for a combination of reasons in the current market. We looked back and we wrote 9 checks out of our fund in 2023. 4 were new investments into new companies that were raising capital for the first time, and 5 were follow-on investments in existing portfolio companies. Of those 5, there was 1 that was an extension round, raising more money from existing investors at the last round's valuation. But the other 4 were up rounds led by new institutional investors. So out of those 9 rounds, maybe you'd say the 1 flat round extension company might not be as excited about announcing. But those other 8, those are 4 new deals and 4 companies raising up rounds led by institutional investors in a tough market. Only 1 of those companies decided in 2023 to announce that funding round. We're not a part of that decision. We let our founders, of course, you know, do that if and when they would like. And some of those deals may end up being announced in 2024. We'll see. But that suggests to me that there are many other unannounced funding rounds that are outside of our portfolio that likely, if reported, would at least paint a marginally less gloomy version of the picture that I think, you know, many people have been seeing and consuming and all that. And so I would expect that it will appear certainly that fundraising activity picks up in 2024. I think you will start to see more of these deals announced, and you may see some of the 2023 deals starting to get announced. I think investors with dry powder are more excited about investing in 2024 than almost any year prior, just given the pendulum having swung toward investor friendliness. And if I can circle back to our conversations about, you know, what causes startups to perhaps be on a less than desirable trajectory, one of the things that happened during the time of easier money is that companies were built with just the wrong or perhaps unsustainable DNA. And when you build a company, there are decisions you make in the early days that are somewhat irreversible. You create a culture around things like cost consciousness and spending and, you know, even, you know, what hotels do your employees stay at when they're going to conferences, and, you know, how diligent are you at seeking refunds for a $9.99, you know, charge that you have a claim to a refund to, and little things even like that, all the way up to bigger decisions. They really make a mark. And not only are valuations much more favorable and terms much more favorable to investors, but companies that are built and launching today, they have profitability and unit economics and cost consciousness built into the fabric of their DNA in a way that many companies, you know, that were launched during a time of easier money just don't, and in a way that's really hard to retrofit. And so for all those reasons, I think, you know, again, many investors don't have dry powder, but those that do are incredibly excited about deploying capital at favorable terms in really high quality companies that are built for profitability in 2024. And I think that combined with perhaps an easing or more accommodating viewpoint on announcing funding rounds will at least give the perception in 2024 that more activity is taking place. On the flip side, I also do think 2024 will be a really trying year where companies that were able to get a little extra capital to extend their runway are not going to be able to get more. And I think you'll see a lot more creative M&A, soft landings, smaller companies, you know, merging, combining, acqui-hiring. Because if you do not have product market fit, and especially if you've already gone back to your investors for one or two extension rounds and not proved what you said you would approve, I do think this will be quite a difficult year.
Right. Benji, a question to you as well is, you know, if we assume that most startups within our industry are there to serve the operators in one way or the other, what type of suppliers are the operators looking for right now? And for you as an investor, do you think from that perspective as well, when you consider an investment, what are the operators hungry for right now? Or I could misunderstand this, that it could be that there are other opportunities out there that are independent of these few operators that exist in the North American market today. But is that part of the dynamic at play here? Why perhaps some startups are struggling, that there just isn't enough customers to serve? Do you see that as well?
Yeah, look, I mean, if you're a US-focused company on the B2B side, sledding has gotten a little bit tougher with some of the consolidation that we've seen. But I think the flip side to that is that if you're a B2B company focused on the US space, I think a number of these operators, let's call it the North American space for argument's sake, I think a number of these operators are better positioned today to look at your picks and shovel business from a product standpoint that could be a benefit to them and or an M&A standpoint. I think they're better positioned to have the headspace for that today than they would have been in any previous year of the five or five and a half years of post-PASPA, of their incarnation into the U.S. market as an iGaming operator. And the reason I say that is in year one, when those operators were just getting going, they weren't focused on your B2B picks and shovel business and how it can help them. They were focused on the land grab of getting live in as many states as they could, as quickly as possible. This was applicable for both companies that are around today and a slew of, you know, tier two companies or tier three companies that no longer are around today because they expanded too quickly and didn't have the deep enough pockets and to compete with those tier ones. And you know, I think that was applicable year one and year two and year three and year four because more and more states were opening up. And I think the majority of operators were very focused on executing against that and on getting live in those states and in some instances bringing their iGaming components into an individual state. As we look at 2024, there isn't a whole lot of action as it pertains to new states opening up. You know, we're not going to see California or Texas this year. You know, the Florida launch has the limitations that we're all aware of. So it's not a scenario in which operators who are now a lot better at getting live in states, they've got 5 years of practice, and even then, they're not really focusing on getting into a whole bunch of new states because there's not a bunch of new states to go into. So what are they focused on? They're focused on how do we maximize what we have internally? How do we become better at operating? How do we improve our pricing? How do we bring on board new products that can make us more differentiated in the marketplace? And I think that to that end, a number of the B2B providers that are coming into the market with interesting product market fits are going to find a softening landscape as it pertains to being able to potentially achieve success with some of those operators and see a path to revenue that might have been a harder path 3 or 4 years ago.
Brilliant, Benny. And as a final question on this point, can you take just 1 minute and perhaps mention one startup, one organization that you're paying very close attention to as one of the most exciting opportunities here, perhaps? Lloyd, do you want to begin? 1 minute.
Put you on the spot. I will mention that one of our favorite portfolio companies, Almost Friday Media, they launched their own line of beer. It's currently only available in the Boston area, but it is absolutely delicious. You can't even find it on shelves because the demand is so high, but I have a few cases in my fridge if anyone lives in New York City and wants a taste, and otherwise you'll have to see what cities they come to next. On the software side, I'll mention two companies, not by name because they still haven't been announced, but these are two companies we're really excited about from deals in 2023. One is a group of industry executives from well-known tier one operators who have gotten together and are launching a poker casino focused platform. I'll leave it at that. And then another that we did just before the new year is in the streaming and OTT space and involves streaming of sports content for some of the largest sports properties and leagues in the world. And I think that'll be an announcement people are quite impressed with when it comes out. So stay tuned for those. And in the meantime, especially if you're in the Boston area, grab a case of Friday beers. They are delicious.
Bendy, one company, 1 minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not a huge beer guy, Lloyd, but I'll see if I can grab one of those next time I'm in the Massachusetts area. I almost want to shy away, Pierre, from giving actual company names, but maybe look at a couple of maybe categories within as such that I think are interesting for this year. I think one would be, you know, Lloyd touched on it, or maybe he didn't, but for me, I think that the entire sweeps area on the B2C side, I think is really interesting as we look at 2024. I think we'll see some interesting, you know, some additional companies emerging that will have potential in varying verticals. So something I think that I have my eye out for per se. And then I think that we should be keeping a really close eye on the reg tech space. I think it's ripe for roll up. I think it's ripe for expansion. I think there's some interesting and some compelling companies on various areas within that. AML would be one area that I would look at. And there's one or two companies in that space that I think are on a compelling trajectory for sure. So those would be a couple of my answers without getting into the specifics of company names. So I've apologized, Pierre, for ducking the question, but maybe read between the lines.
I forgive you, Bendy. And so for the fourth segment here today, we are really happy to be joined here today by Charles Gillespie, the CEO and founder of Gambling.com Group. Great to have you here with us, Charles. How are you doing today?
All good here, guys. Thanks for having me on.
It is an absolute pleasure. And we wanted to kind of do a little bit of a deep dive into Gambling.com Group today, Charles. But I'll tell you something. You know, I noticed in the research to this segment, I went to your LinkedIn page to kind of check out your history and your background and so on. And I noticed that there was only one work experience that you have in your resume for LinkedIn, which is Gambling.com Group, because the company was founded all the way back in 2005, of course. And so I wanted to kind of start off on that point. You know, even though the company was listed on the stock market in New York in 2021, the company, of course, has a long history. Can you talk a little bit about those early days as a startup founder and how you got to where you are today?
Sure, happy to do it. So I'm from North Carolina originally, went to the University of North Carolina. Got introduced to the industry in 2003, stumbled across my first kind of online gambling affiliate program, started my own online gambling affiliate site, the aptly known startgamblingonline.com. Was bouncing around doing different digital marketing things in university. I was always a geek, always knew how to make websites, always wanted to make a little bit of money on the side. And in my sophomore year at UNC, I met a new group of guys that were big time poker players. And my roommate that year when I met him, he made $20,000 playing poker online in 2004. And, you know, that was,
Chris Moneymaker.
Wait for the end of the story. So by Christmas, he made $100,000. By the summer, he made $1 million. He went on to make about $2 million. And all of us obviously found that highly intriguing and also started to play quite a bit. The rest of us did okay. We made enough money to live very, very well in university. And I made enough to get this off of the ground, but nothing like our friend who is quite gifted. But I was graduating at the, in 2006, 2005, I started kind of thinking, all right, what am I going to do here? Am I going to go get a job? Am I going to be a consultant at McKinsey? Am I going to, I studied political science. Am I going to go do something, in politics or government? And I was speaking to a family friend, and I kind of laid all these different things that I could do. And there were four or five different things. And by the time I got to what was essentially the very beginning of this company, he said, look, I don't understand that at all. It makes no sense to me, but you need to do that because that you came alive. You lit up when you started talking about that. So clearly that's where your heart is and you need to do that. And that was very good advice. And so I graduated. I had built what was a sports betting affiliate site for the Chinese market, actually, in 2006. Because in the U.S., there was no regulation in the U.S. There was no regulated online gambling in America in 2006. So, my kind of big idea at the time, which was very naive and just how you think as a young person without having kind of, been hit in the face with the real world of business and product market fit and everything else. But, I'm like, okay, if I can't do this in the United States, well, what's the next biggest country in the world full of people that love to gamble? China. Well, China's booming. I'll just go do it in China. Why would you not? And,
how hard can it be?
Exactly. So, that's when I linked up with Kevin, who's the co-founder at gambling.com group. Kevin's one of my oldest friends. I had talked to a friend of a university professor into basically financing phase one of this. And so Kevin and I moved to Shanghai and hired 25 Chinese people and built out the very first gambling affiliate site that we ever did at scale. And, the idea was monetize China. The investment thesis in the very beginning was China will regulate and will be the ESPN of China, it'll be great. So we did 3 or 4 years on the ground in China, had a time of our lives. We had a lot of access to some very senior people in the startup scene in China, because we had made a couple of good connections. And at the time in 2006, 7, 8, you had the Olympics in Beijing and China was really open, much more so than now. And there was a totally vibrant Silicon Valley style startup scene in Shanghai. And there's a lot of expats, there's a lot of Americans, there were venture capitalists everywhere. It was really a fascinating time to be there. And we really hit the ground running. We made a lot of the right connections and learned a lot, and pretty quickly realized, okay, if anybody's going to make a fortune in online gambling in China, it's probably not two dudes from North Carolina. Let's reassess here and see how we might shift focus to make this work. And also, there was no signs that they were going to regulate after a couple of years. So what we had done is we built this website, WSN.com, which was the sports betting affiliate site. And it was we had a mainland China version. We had a like Hong Kong, Taiwan version. And then we had an English language version for the UK. And that was actually making a bit of money. So that was keeping the lights on, helping us pay the bills. And we left China 2009-10. Closed the office down out there, cultivated the English version of WSN, all flew to Malta. After living in Shanghai, we said, okay, pollution, you know, super urban environment. You know, this is kind of tiring. What's the polar opposite of Shanghai? Well, Malta. So we'll go to Malta and do a few few years in Malta. And then, you know, pretty quickly realize, okay, this isn't going to work either because we're not European. We can't get work permits. We can't even live here, you know. And we figured starting a business, investing a bit of money would be enough. And at the time, you know, we really just didn't, it was not a successful company at that point. You know, we were keeping the lights on, but it was, you know, we were still in kind of beg, borrow, steal mode. And so eventually Kevin and the other remaining team members went back to the US. Kevin went to New York. One of our kind of third in command went down to Florida, and I stuck around in Europe. I had a little bit of poker money left over, and you know, I kind of wanted to be in Europe for personal reasons anyways. And then we got a phone call April 2011 about the gambling.com domain name, which really is the kind of beginning of the modern era of the group. We had already started pivoting into online casino and away from sports betting. You know, that's from just a pure digital marketing standpoint, that's a more compelling business for us today. And, you know, 15 years ago, it was also, I think, you know, it's just a more pure play digital marketing opportunity. You know, sports betting affiliate, you can make it real complicated. You can build all kinds of complex, interesting content. At the end of the day, casino is about search rankings. And, you know, the product needs to be there too, but you really just need to be able to deliver on your search performance. And so we went right at that, and that was starting to work. And, you know, we've been working with Mark Blandford at that point. Blandford is the founder of Sportingbet, and, you know, he's done a lot of investing in the industry. So he helped us take down the domain name gambling.com. And when we got it, it was dead on arrival. So it was literally just a domain name, didn't make any money. And we had to really rebuild it from scratch. You know, it and the first two months we had it, I think it generated one NDC, you know, so, it was really, you know, a start at the beginning situation. And it took us a few years to get real momentum with it. But by 2015, things were going very well. We needed a proper European office. That's when we set up in Ireland, which remains today our biggest operating entity. So we got about 150 people in Ireland. We've got about 150 people in the US. We've got people around Europe. We've got Malta, of course. We've got over 50 people in Malta. We've got a couple of other European offices. We have some offices in Central America as well. And yeah, you know, that kind of brings us to the modern era. 2021, we did the IPO in New York. So we're the first and remain the only online gambling performance marketing company publicly traded in the United States. I wouldn't have ever guessed that would be the case in 2021. You know, now and looking back in 2024, I thought we'd have some company by now, but we're still the only ones in the US.
Right, and very interesting, Charles, to hear the backstory there. I just have one question before I leave the word over to Lloyd, perhaps. But you know, you've grinded this company for a long time before you saw success, and today, obviously, you're still the CEO almost 20 years later, with hundreds and hundreds of employees. And I'm just curious to know, from a founder and kind of leader point of view, how important do you feel it is to kind of evolve during the years from running a small company to now running a massive stock listed company? As a leader, you must be going through a lot of evolutions and so on and so forth, especially as well going from a company that is struggling to a company that is making a good amount of money and so on. Can you talk a little bit about like what it takes to evolve in this kind of journey as a leader?
Yeah. Well, you've got to have great mentors that have been there and done it before. Otherwise, you'll lose too much time trying to figure it out yourself. But, you know, the way you run a 25-person company is completely different than the way you run a 75-person company, in that it's completely different again at 200 people. And then at, you know, 400 or 500, it changes again. So you've got to have, you know, it's not rocket science. If, you know, as long as you're kind of open-minded and willing to learn from other people's experience and you have that experience around, you know, you can do it. But, you know, it is pretty rare that startup founders take the company all the way through to an IPO. And, I would really credit that to, you know, we've got a great board, we've got great investors. You know, I've had the great fortune of being able to learn from people that have done this before and not had to reinvent the wheel. And I also, you know, give a big shout out to my partner in crime, Kevin. I mean, Kevin has also taken it, you know, nearly 20 years in the COO role. And that is, in many respects, a role which is much harder to, that role changes much more dramatically than the CEO role. You know, from day one, I've had to deal with the board of directors. I've had to deal with fundraising. I've had to deal with crafting a compelling story and building excitement, motivating the team. A lot of that stuff doesn't really change, whether it's 25 people or 500 people. But, you know, that role of the COO to coordinate the organization, to design an organization, to identify all the different roles, to find the right people for those roles, and then to constantly reinvent it every, you know, 6, 12, 18 months as the company scales to ensure that that company structure remains fit for purpose at each, you know, as things grow. That's hard, you know, and I've got a lot of respect for Kevin and how he's been able to do that for us.
I have a question that probably seems so trivial, but I'm personally curious. It sounds like that moment or the series of moments when you pursued and maybe raised some funding to pursue the gambling.com domain was somewhat monumental, if nothing else, than in retrospect. Had you always had specifically gambling.com as something you had your eye on? Were there three or four other, I don't know, casino.com or jackpot.com or other sort of generic gambling related one word names? Or was there something about gambling.com specifically that you always had your eye on?
No, not really. In April 2011, when we got the call about it, you know, we hadn't been planning to receive that call and had to kind of quickly get our thoughts together on it. We had always fully appreciated and valued these premier domain names. No one had to convince us that it was worth a lot of money. That was clear. What I will say is that once we got our hands on gambling.com, you know, that enabled us to, we brought more investment into the business. We hired more people, we scaled the business, and then we've kept going. So we've bought bookmakers.com. We've bought bookies.com. We've bought casinos.com at the end of 2022. And casinos.com is one that I have had my eye on for a very long time. And that is one that I am very happy to have added to the stable. And I think in time, it could be bigger than gambling.com. You know, gambling.com is, it doesn't translate as well to foreign languages. You know, the word for gambling in you know, any non-English language, it's never gambling. You know, the word for casino in many non-English languages is casino. And casino is where the money's at. You know, it's, you know, gambling kind of has to cover everything. You got to do a little bit of poker, a little bit of sports betting, a little bit of bingo, you know, but casinos, we just go straight at where the, you know, most lucrative opportunities are. So we can also, you know, there's a nice kind of land-based angle to casinos as well. You know, a casino is a physical place that you can go and visit. Gambling is a concept. You know, this isn't a short-term priority, but in time, we will be able to naturally extend the casinos.com website to cover land-based in a more, you know, natural way than we would do any of our other sites.
I love the amount of thought that you have put into just each of these words and the differences and the nuances. And it seems like, in your view, for an affiliate, having a ultra premium domain like this is just an unmitigated positive impact at pretty much every step of your journey. I'm curious if you have even any view on this for other types of companies that are not affiliates for whom their URL is so prominent, especially for B2B companies, but even maybe, you know, a B2C operator or a media company. If you were advising an early stage founder outside the affiliate space and they were thinking of paying big for a really short, zippy, ultra premium domain name, what advice would you give them? What would you tell them about some of the maybe intangible benefits that you enjoyed. It sounds like on the fundraising side, even having such a premium domain was helpful. I'm sure any founders would love to hear any thoughts you have on being an early stage company and considering what feels like maybe an unwieldy price, but for a really unique and premium domain.
Look, every situation is different, but I wouldn't be afraid to invest in a premium domain name. Definitely don't rent one. Don't get into any sort of weird domain agreement if you can't afford it. Either buy it or don't. These things aren't actually that easy to sell. You know, the universe of people that are willing to pay millions of dollars for a gambling industry domain name is not very big. You know, yes, there's a lot of money in this industry. There's a lot of smart people, but there are distressed sales. There are situations where people need to get more liquid. So, if you can be patient, good stuff always comes to market. But it's a pretty safe area to invest. But every situation's dependent, unique. And if you're a startup, cash is king. So it's one of these hard questions, which can make or break a business.
Hey, Charles, first of all, I'm going to jump in for a second, Pierre. First of all, hearing the entire story and the trajectory, obviously, we could probably dive into the nuance of it for 2 or 3 hours if we wanted to, but really one of the more compelling stories within our space, just given the length and the tenure and the partnership of yourself and Kevin over the years. So thanks for sharing it and joining us. I want to shift the tables a little bit. And obviously here at Vested Interest, we talk a lot about investments and M&A. And, I know that you at gambling.com and your company have been, somewhat active in that regard. I'd love to just get your perspective as to how you as a founder and the leader of a publicly traded company think about acquisition. Once you make those decisions to make an acquisition, how you think about incorporating, a culture into your culture and their practices into your practices, and what you look for in those companies and in those founders, and what are some of the traits that you're looking for that you think will make it a successful fit and a good fit for you and your organization?
Well, the way we look at M&A in general is that it is a nice to have. It's not a need to have. A lot of the companies that do what we do in the sector, they're basically roll-ups. They buy, some of our peers have done 60, 70 deals. We've only ever done 6 deals. So our North Star has always been organic growth. If we can't grow this thing ourselves, we're doing it wrong. And that has to be the spine. If you can't grow one of these businesses in an industry which is growing by triple digit, industry growth rates in certain markets, then you should be asking yourself some pretty hard questions. But if you do it right and you have a lot of organic growth and you have a nice business, you're going to throw off a lot of cash. Well, then you have an opportunity to actually do some M&A. And do it in a capital efficient way where you're not diluting yourself every time you go out there and do it. And that's really how we think about it. So we're not anti M&A at all. We're just really picky, and we're picky because we can afford to be picky because we don't have any problem relying on our own organic growth. We have had the highest organic growth of any of our peers, I think every single year for, 5 or 6 years now. But we did 2 really great deals at the beginning of 2022 after the IPO. We bought RotoWire and we bought FinCEN's business, Bonus Finder, and that Bonus Finder deal turned out to be one of the biggest affiliate deals of all time because they really delivered on the earnout and got paid for that. And we got a great deal. Everybody was really happy with that deal in the end. And that's, it's a perfect example of the kind of M&A that we want to do. We want to work with businesses which have passionate, motivated teams behind them that we can work with, that care about organic growth, that if we buy something, we need to be able to continue to grow it. We're not going to buy it if it's not growing. And therefore, you know, that like-minded people that we can work with that think about the world in the same way as us, you know, have a kind of similar cultural disposition about how to build a business, that makes a massive difference. You know, you can, you know, I think there's plenty of studies of M&A activity, and I think the average M&A transaction destroys shareholder value. So you have to be careful about this. You can't just go out and, you know, do as many deals as you want. You know, you need, I think it's very sensible to be very picky about it. You know, and despite that, you know, we have some peers that have managed to do a ton of deals and make it work and succeed. So, you know, there's more than one way to do this, but we've got our own particular view of the world and we stick to it.
I want to jump in the, here with the last question of today, Charles, for you, if I may. So I'm really curious about your thoughts on the advent of generative AI. Obviously, the launch of ChatGPT has catapulted generative AI in the last 12 months. And it's not a secret that there are a lot of startups now that are popping up that are targeting affiliates in order to create kind of automated content production. And that kind of leads to a world where we will eventually live in infinite content on the internet, essentially, with the use of AI. How do you think about the future of SEO affiliation, considering this future of potential infinite content?
It's a great question. That's kind of the question, you know, of the current moment. It's something we spend a lot of time thinking about. You know, I think there's a couple different sides here. There's the cost and process side of delivery, you know, just can we create the content more efficiently than we were creating it previously? And the answer is, well, yeah, you know, it's not, it ain't, ChatGPT ain't making any of this harder. That's for sure. You know, we have always kind of shied away from a lot of this automation stuff because it's not actually that expensive to just pay someone to write the article. You know, you know, the uniqueness and the quality of that article is so critical from a search perspective. It feels like a weird place to economize. But if I just put on my kind of technology, you know, hat, I don't know, half of the content on the internet is going to be produced by LLMs, you know, possibly this year. I mean, you know, this is happening now. So, and it ain't like Google can really tell. Nobody can really tell if it was produced by an LLM or not. So I think it's getting blurry. We haven't gone all in on it yet, and I'm not sure we will, but you know, we do definitely use it now at the margins to help accelerate the production of certain you know, pieces of content and other processes inside the business. I think the more interesting question is, how is this potentially going to affect consumer search behavior? You know, are people going to go to chatbots, personal assistants to find the best online casinos? Or are they going to continue to go to search engines to find the best online casinos? And we certainly haven't seen any evidence so far that that has changed in any way whatsoever. You know, business for us is, you know, that search model is working in the exact same way that it always has. But having discussed this with other CEOs in other industries, you know, if you want to buy a laptop online, apparently that has changed. You know, the consumer search intent and behavior behind things like buying a laptop is a bit different now than it was a year ago, because of the assistance that they can get from a, you know, LLM based, you know, generative search response. I think gambling is somewhat insulated from some of these things because, you know, Google and Bing have always had a bit of a, they've kept the industry at a safe distance. You know, they want to make money off the industry, but they also don't want to be embroiled in any sort of scandal or issues related to the industry. You know, there was a long time where Google wouldn't even let you do AdWords in regulated markets. You know, there was a period in the UK when they literally wouldn't take the money. So, and that comes from the top, as far as we understand. You know, they have always had a very cautious approach to gambling. So I think that's a really good thing here. And I don't think that Google and Bing for that matter will really be pushing aggressively into the gambling side of things with their LLMs. You know, they got enough opportunity elsewhere and they have enough reputational risk in this particular neighborhood to move a little slower. And so, you know, it's not something that we are immediately concerned about, but it is definitely something that we're thinking about and watching closely.
Right. Interesting, Charles. So we might look for a new generation of affiliates that are AIO affiliates in the future, AI optimization affiliates, I suppose, rather than SEO. Interesting insight there. Well, Charles, thank you so much for giving us your time. Super insightful to learn more about gambling.com group, and congratulations to all the success. To my co-hosts, Lloyd and Benji, thank you so much, like always, for a great episode. And I wish you all a great rest of the day here, gentlemen. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Charles.
Take care.